Well, I think that being alive is an anomalous experience.
It is. I've been trying to interview our next guest since I started American Alchemy a couple of years ago. Her book was perhaps the biggest catalyst for my early interest in UFOs. Her name is mentioned in literally every interview I've done.
Diana Pasulka.
Diana Pasulka.
Diana Pasulka.
Diana Pasulka.
I love her book, American Cosmic. I love her work.
And yes, she's American Alchemy's white whale, or Moby Dick, if you will.
I've never been so trolled in my life.
Yeah. We finally caught up to her in Palo Alto, right after the launch of her new book, Encounters, and before Gary Nolan's Seoul Conference, a meeting of some of the best academic, military, and civilian minds in UFO research at Stanford University.
We don't believe or disbelieve in my field, but I fully didn't believe. I was like, why are people believing in these things that they miss seeing, say, in the sky?
Diana is a religious studies professor at University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She's versed in the classics and maintains a deep knowledge of Catholic history. While doing research for a book on purgatory she wrote, called Heaven Can Wait in 2014, she began to document dozens of historical cases of nuns, priests, brothers, and saints who had reported direct divine or angelic contact. But here's where the story gets interesting. Dr. Pasulka did her own translations of these contact experiences. She didn't take the official church translations for granted, and in many cases, her direct translations didn't exactly sound like the official versions of the story. Take St. Francis of Assisi, a 12th century Italian friar. The popular narrative is that St. Francis saw Christ under the appearance of a seraph or angel on Mount Laverna in Italy. But the first English translations of this experience from Thomas of Celano don't mention anything about Christ. Instead, the original translations describe Francis encountering a sound and fury, atmospheric sparks, and a flaming torch. Telepathic communication between Francis and the torch occurs, in which Francis is treated harshly and wounded with rays of light that rip through his hands. Francis's wounds get interpreted as Christ's stigmata.
This looks very similar to things that people talk about today.
Radiation damage.
Yeah.
Could this be the same radiation damage that occurs in what we now call UFO experiences?
The people getting like burns, mm-hmm. So that's ultraviolet, that's like ionizing radiation. So that would be light being blue shifted into the ultraviolet as it's lensed across the bubble that the craft creates, and you're getting literally a sunburn.
Are modern gray aliens just the angels or demons of times past?
You had like, witches sitting on the chests of people feeling paralyzed in medieval times. It's like our overlay is this classic alien kind of motif.
And what about flying saucers or discs? Are they just the flaming chariots or burning shields or wheels of antiquity?
Ezekiel saw the wheel, baby. I'm waiting.
What we're talking about is in some sense a modern reformation. Just as Martin Luther believed the word of God was all one needed for salvation, Diana is going back to the original texts and translations of divine contact events and finding all sorts of commonalities with modern day alien contact experiences.
This is a new form of religion. It's not just a religion, because we do have UFO religions, right?
Yeah.
But this is a new form of religion.
And the contemporary mythology defines how we discuss or recollect these experiences. As French philosopher Henri Bergson wrote, the eyes can only see what the mind is prepared to comprehend.
People have been seeing the same stuff. Like, so the Tic Tac of today was the flying butane tank of the 1950s.
It's almost like you have like a meme library in your head, and then you have this higher platonic thing that's happening, and you attach the closest meme that you can to it.
Yeah, exactly.
So are we just now getting closer to the root layer of religion, understanding its proto-architecture, its universal, timeless nature?
Maybe we're looking at the source code.
The point is, we're all getting a little closer to the light, seeing beyond the shadows of Plato's cave, and Diana is helping us get there. So on that note, please enjoy this riveting, simulation-breaking conversation with this week's American Alchemist, Dr. Diana Walsh Pasulka.
Different parts of the brain have different activities.
But you know that, don't you?
Maybe you should interview me.
Diana Walsh Pasulka is an amazing religious studies professor at UNC Wilmington. She's the author of two books, American Cosmic and Encounters. And I think people don't even realize that before David Grush, you were almost the first person in the civilian context to out these sort of secret space programs. And the book is incredible. I'm so grateful you're here. I know we've tried to make this happen a few times, and I'm just honored to be with you.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to be here, and thanks for the invite. I think the first thing that maybe we want to talk about is that American Cosmic opens at a crash retrieval site. That was in 2016 that I went with people that I had to have as pseudonyms. Okay, so now Gary Nolan has come out, and that's actually a relief to me that he's come out as himself. And the reason why we went was because Tyler, who's still a pseudonym for a person who is a mission controller and works in the Space Force, and I'd been studying this topic, but truly I didn't believe in it, right? I just was on the fence of belief or disbelief, which is kind of the method that we use. We don't believe or disbelieve in my field, but I fully didn't believe. Yeah. I was like, why are people believing in these things, that they missee, say, in the sky? And belief has gone up. And so I wanted to know why. And I had a feeling it had to do with entertainment media, right? And that's what I was looking at.
And the implication with Tyler is almost, because he worked on the NASA Challenger mission, and he had a colleague, an astronaut, famously die in 86, and he worked on a lot of space missions since then and high up in NASA. And the implication is almost from your book that he's using his consciousness in some way in mission control, or was he somehow, because he feels very tapped into some sort of network where he gets ideas. He says that he goes to a room where there's a machine, and he doesn't know exactly what the machine does, but he gets a lot of ideas about biomedical innovations and goes on to actually start companies that are super successful. And so what is the link between space fare and consciousness? Is there a clear link, or?
Well, okay, these are things that I think we're working out.
Yeah.
So what I noticed was exactly what you noticed.
Yeah.
So the trajectory of his professional life was incredibly lucky.
Yes, yeah.
Like, this was a guy who was so lucky that it just seemed improbable.
Right.
How could you be that lucky?
Right.
You know? I mean, also, he wasn't the best in college.
Yeah.
Almost flunked out even.
That's interesting.
And didn't go to the best college,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so the more...
How did he get into space?
I know. Well, yeah, he told me all these stories about, yeah, how these things happened to him. And every time he told me a story about this, I was like, that's highly unlikely and,
yeah,
improbable.
Yeah.
But it did truly happen.
Right.
So we begin to, like, see what he did. I begin to, like, study him, right?
Yeah.
So he had a protocol. He'd use these things that I later called protocols.
Mm-hmm.
But they reminded me, as a person who studies religion, these protocols that people use in each religion. And one of them, obviously, is prayer or meditation in the Eastern traditions. Actually, at the time, I started to practice these protocols because,
yeah,
I was really incredibly busy,
yeah,
and drank too much coffee, you know, didn't sleep well. It wasn't a bad life. It's just that I was really busy. So he would talk about connecting. He would go into some type of a state. When he woke up, he made sure he got a lot of sleep. He made sure that he was hydrated. Okay. Well, now we know why hydration is really important, because, you know, our bodies are like 80% water around that. And water conducts. So if there are electrical things happening, you just have to be hydrated. And so he made sure he was hydrated. So he made sure that his biophysical self was able to connect with this thing that he said, he explained how it felt. It would feel like a signal coming in. And then he would get the information that he needed to do these technologies or create these businesses.
So this is it's kind of a crazy, weird question, but Jacques Vallée has clearly influenced you a lot.
Yes.
Sort of
yeah.
In some ways, the godfather of modern UFO research, one of the early pioneers of the internet, but also talked about how UFOs work as sort of control systems, intermittent reinforcement to sort of maybe control societies in ways that we don't even fully understand. And he's also interested in fallen angels. You talk about this in Encounters.
That's right.
And
also demons. And so angels and demons, what does this have to do with modern ufology?
So this is a scene in Encounters.
Yes.
Where I'm having lunch with Jacques Vallée. So we're in his study and it's really amazingly beautiful here in the Bay Area. And he starts to, explain a couple of things to me. And I notice a bunch of books on shelves and I notice those things, right?
Yeah.
So I go and I start to look to see what he has on this one shelf. And then he takes one of the books off and it was a book about angels. And he says, of course, you can't have one without the other, right?
Mm.
And so we went out and had some coffee and pastries in his living room. And so we talked and he asked me what I learned from Tyler.
Yeah.
He said, what did we learn from Tyler? And at the time, I was like, you got my book. You know, I was thinking, you got my book, Jacques, you know. But then I thought, what did we learn from Tyler? So I couldn't really answer him. And thankfully, I took too long to answer him because he picked up another book and he said, you need to read this book. And whenever he says that to me, of course, I'm going to get the book and read it. But this one was weird. So he showed it to me and it was The History of Satan. It just had these big words on it that says Satan. And again, if I wasn't a little bit concerned before, I was absolutely concerned at that point. I was like, you know, Jacques Vallée is handing me this book that says Satan on it. And so he said, look at the pagination. So I, you know, looked at the pagination. It was 666.
Whoa.
Yeah. I thought that was so, you know, of course.
Wild.
It was a really weird moment. And he said that in the States, we think of Satan or the devil as really, really terrible, right? But, you know, he said that the French, they have a different view of it. And it's less sensationalist. Mm. That's what he was saying. And then he had another bookshelf and it was the same thing. So he picked out a book and he made a joke. You know, he's really funny, as you know, right? He's super funny.
Yeah.
And so he made a joke and he said,
feels like he's always trolling you a little bit.
I'm serious. That's exactly how he is. He is.
And it's almost like the work that he talks about where, you know, it's like the sound of one hand clapping the Zen cone or whatever, the absurdity of the phenomena itself. It almost feels like it comes through him and the way he speaks is sort of like confusing. And it's like he throws like a smoke bomb and you're like, what did you say? And you end up trying to parse it even more than you would if it were immediately clear. Cause you would just be like, okay, yeah, I'll meet you at this place or whatever. But he uses a word and you're like, what's going on there? And then sort of you're more motivated to.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
My son, burn it. It is from the devil.
I've never been so trolled in my life.
Yeah.
Throughout this whole study.
Right.
You know, I was just like this normal kind of professor of religious studies doing my thing. And all of a sudden, boom. And all of a sudden, my life, you know, becomes this crazy town.
Well, that the hermeneutic reading of American Cosmic is that you start out this analytical, rigorous academic. And it's all of a sudden the, you know, observer observed wall breaks down and you are sort of converted yourself into a UFO believer.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
I know. It's really, really so strange.
Here's why Diana's book, American Cosmic, changed me and many people I know forever. It starts off not only skeptical of UFOs, but as a pretty rational academic take on the subject. In fact, the first half of the book almost reads like a dismissal of UFOs as a modern psyop, discussing how TV and media are very influential in defining how people recollect their alien or UFO sightings. For example, she talks about Betty and Barney Hill in 1961 seeing aliens with eyes wrapped around the rim of their heads. But were they just being subliminally influenced by the CBS show Outer Limits that also show aliens with horizontal slit-like eyes? The show premiered just a couple of weeks before the couple's reported abduction experience. Diana also writes about the monolith in 2001 Space Odyssey and how it may not represent an alien artifact that inspires tech innovation, but actually a digital screen that manipulates our 3D lower reality. In fact, 2001's director, Stanley Kubrick, said in a 1969 interview that interpreting the monolith as an alien artifact is the movie's most superficial interpretation. Kubrick even initially experimented with the monolith literally being a screen that flashes targets for the apes to hit with rocks, almost a visual hunting manual, flashing shapes and colors for the apes to learn increasingly abstract concepts and evolve. In the novelized version of 2001, written by Arthur C. Clarke, the monolith above astronaut David Bowman's bed was actually just a TV. So is the monolith just the smokescreen in Plato's cave? Diana goes even deeper on the possibility of a UFO psyop. She gets into modern UFO cults like Dorothy Martin and her followers, a group of Midwestern rapturists that believe that they were recipients of a UFO prophecy about an impending apocalypse in 1954, which of course never happened. Okay, so media subtly influences our UFO experiences, the monolith isn't an alien artifact, it's a screen that manipulates our reality, and we have a bunch of crazy UFO cults running around. Are modern UFOs just a psyop built in a Disney studio? But as soon as you're ready to write UFOs off as a big psyop, something kind of crazy happens in the book. She meets the pseudonymously named Tyler, who worked as a NASA mission controller since the 80s, but also worked in an alleged secret space program where he used specific protocols to mentally download information instrumental for biotech companies that he founded.
He's definitely atypical of a Space Force guy, you know, rocket scientist. You have a certain stereotype of these guys, and they're not driving really awesome cars or flying around in jets, but that's what he was doing. He actually said he was interested in what I studied. And, you know, I study religious studies. Now, he's not the first aerospace guy who's asked me about my work. So I had been asked by some people that I later found out were part of what we call the Invisible College, these scientists who study, you know, this topic. And I had been doing some work on pretty much historical angel events.
Yeah.
And they wanted to see what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I thought, who are these people from an aerospace company who are interested in this? And so I sent him the work, right?
She also meets Dr. Gary Nolan, a tenured Stanford professor and microbiologist with his own mental protocols. Dr. Nolan would later go on to use his Stanford lab to attempt to do material science analysis on what he thinks might be UFO crash parts. Tyler takes Diana and Gary blindfolded to a UFO crash site in New Mexico together.
It was a secret place. On government land, it was a New Mexico crash retrieval place. And it was a place that, you know, it was not Roswell, but this is what Tyler told me. He said there were a few crashes that happened in the 1940s.
They then find UFO crash materials with anomalous isotope ratios not generally found on Earth.
We did find things, but they weren't easy to find. If they were placed there, they were placed so far down, rocks that had been there for looked like 100 years, you know, like stuff that you just couldn't get.
If all of this sounds insane, it initially did to me too, but reality is insane, or at least it's a little weirder than you think.
It's so interesting.
I know, it's really, really so strange. The thing about it is it's a both and.
Mm.
So you say, you know, at first you think the book is gonna be about Walt Disney did it all and psyoped us and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's both and.
Yes.
It's like, yes, there were psyops that happened. And yes, there is a phenomenon that exists. And so I guess that is the hardest thing to convey, is that people want either or. You know, they want it either there's nothing and we're being fooled and, you know, bad on you, government, or it's really the space people are here and they're going to save us. What if, I mean, it's way more complicated than that.
And what if per yours and Jacques Vallée's work, where you can compare past, you know, St. Francis of Assisi or the ecstasy of St. Teresa feel like modern alien abduction experiences, and or Jacques Vallée and Passport to Magonia would say, you know, in Celtic medieval Ireland, you might see a leprechaun or a fairy, and now you're seeing an alien. What if it is both? Because I've never seen a document leaked from the government that says we are going to wholesale fabricate UFOs. Like, that never exists. What you do see a lot of is Walter B. Smith, the director of the CIA in 1953, saying we're going to play up the phenomenon for psychological warfare purposes Cold War.
That's right.
So you're using an existing underlying phenomenon for your own purposes.
That's right.
And so the modern space alien stuff, that might be the smoke screen we're seeing. We're just seeing the veil, and we're seeing these sort of low-level memes or motifs, and yet in a weird way, this has been going on transcending space-time. This has been going on across history.
Yeah.
in these really profound ways. And that's not a psyop. That is so real.
Yes.
And the experiences people have are real.
Totally, totally real.
In the late 1800s, while sleeping in her small cell in a Catholic convent, a young nun named Sister Maria was awakened by a shining object, like a flame, that appeared to emerge from her room's wall and hover above her. No one in the convent believed her, but she convinced the Mother Superior to stay up with her one night. Lo and behold, the flame emerged from the wall and hovered over the two women. The Mother Superior determined that the flame must be a soul stuck in purgatory in need of prayer. Now cut to the 20th century, Melissa, in her early 20s, saw a ball of light come through the sliding doors of her apartment, bounce around the room, go down the hall, and into the other room. She followed the light around the room before it went back outside through the same sliding doors. This is an exact description of a UFO encounter from John Mack's 1994 book, Abduction. Mack was the head of the Harvard Psychiatry Department, who devoted the end of his life to studying alien and UFO experiencers. And this description of an orb bouncing around Melissa's room sounds exactly like the 19th century Catholic nun's experience. Are these two experiences the same thing? One with a religious overlay, and the other interpreted as paranormal or extraterrestrial?
In the age of disenchantment and secularization, where even garden variety people who follow religion often don't actually believe in the metaphysical reality of the religion, It almost feels like the most charismatic thing that you can believe is something that really marries science and religion, which the UFO thing does.
Yes.
Because it is both nuts and bolts and space, and it is angels and demons and spirituality.
That's right.
And so there's something highly charismatic about it that I think we would both say on a go forward basis, it's probably just going to keep growing.
Yes.
So what I'm getting at, I guess, is it can be really negative and it can be really positive. And so how do you make sense of that? That it's just like angels and demons, and it can be both. And there's a book called Bedeviled, and it's about the history of demons and science. And, you know, whether it's, you know, James Clerk Maxwell or Laplace or Descartes, a lot of these people had experiences with sort of demonic entities. And so, and Socrates spoke to a daemon, so one letter off from demon. And so and then some of these inventions are like really positive for humanity. And then at other times they're cataclysmic and destructive and horrible. Mm-hmm. So what's going on?
Yeah. Oh gosh, that's a big question, you know? Yeah. Like, how am I going to answer it?
I don't know how you answer
it. How about if I have a conversation about it?
Okay, let's do
okay,
it.
Yeah. Okay,
so. Peripatetic.
Yeah, exactly. Dialectic. Yeah. So it is true that you say it's the UFO melds science and religion, right? And it's not going away. Okay, well, this is what I saw before I wrote American Cosmic, and I said, this is a new form of religion.
Yeah.
It's not just a religion, because we do have UFO religions, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But this is a new form of religion, and this is going to happen. And I kind of tried to stay with that thesis, you know, this is how it's going to happen. And I talked about how media is going to kind of, it's the infrastructure that's going to, this is going to disseminate through all kinds of different screens, right? And we're just going to be converted through these screens. But I didn't figure that I would have experiences myself going through the study of it, and that I would then think, okay, something is happening here. And that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, that's, and now I'm just going to be open about it, because it feels like the cat's out of the bag with all this stuff. I used to try to maintain sort of impartiality.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the book I would always give people when they were skeptical is a book called UFOs and Nukes by a guy named Robert Hastings.
Yeah, great book.
Amazing book. And it's super dry and hard-headed. And that's why I would give it to people. And I recently connected with him 2 weeks ago. And he was like, I've had a lot of anomalous experiences since I've started studying the phenomena. I've had a lot of weird experiences since I've gotten into this. And I've never said this before publicly, but my dad's godfather is a guy named Rod Serling, who created the Twilight Zone and made the most famous UFO documentary in the, I think it was the 50s or 60s. And then I made this thing with Grush or whatever,
you know,
like a couple months ago. And it's just this weird thing where you start to feel even more connected to it in a completely impartial. The goal of science is to stay impartial, but it's sort of impossible with this. And
yeah.
Everybody I know who's at the forefront of disclosure, whether it's you or Gary Nolan or any of the people, they admit that they've had sort of anomalous experiences themselves. Mm-hmm. And so have you had, you don't have to talk about it if you don't feel comfortable, but have you had any experiences like that?
Well, I think that being alive is an anomalous experience.
It is, yeah.
And that we just have defense mechanisms to keep us from recognizing it.
Yes.
And I think what happens is that the UFO comes along and busts your defense mechanisms.
Yes.
So you saw my defense mechanism bust in American Cosmic.
Yes.
And a lot of people did.
Yes.
And then it went out and busted theirs too.
Yes.
Because I was so honest about it. I was like, this is going to happen. It's a new religiosity. You know, let's do this academically. And then boom. Oh, what? This is for real? It is for real. And then, okay, if it's for real, what does it mean? And that's my follow-up was like, so I, you know, yes. My follow-up was like, if it's for real, then what it means is that we better take life pretty darn seriously.
Yes.
Okay, so if it doesn't cause you to go off the deep end, I think what it does is it causes you to, I hate to say this word, but, or this term, but go on the straight and narrow.
Yes, absolutely.
Because if you don't...
I basically don't drink anymore. I have very little caffeine. I never have caffeine,
wow,
basically.
And, wow.
And you feel more sensitive to,
yes, yeah,
reality in, mm-hmm, a way. And, mm-hmm, and then you end up having to go on the straight and narrow.
You have to.
It sort of,
there's
forces,
no choice,
you. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a forcing,
like,
function.
That's what... Oh, very good,
it is.
Jesse. It's a forcing function.
Yes.
I'm going to now use that term. I tried to understand what it was, but when I told people that, these people aren't holy,
yes,
but they are doing this, and they're doing this because they have to do it, and that's not a choice.
You know, these visitations, in a way, are kind of like a modern mystery event. People don't just walk away traumatized. In some cases, they do. But in other cases, I mean, transformed for the better.
Well, it's almost like, as you study this, you become, and this is not scientific terminology, but like a higher frequency but non-specific amplifier or receptor. And so as you get deeper into it, you pick up more, you become much more sensitive, and bad stuff can glom onto you more easily. And so it's almost like C.S. Lewis, the Screwtape Letters, where you have to be hyper-vigilant.
Yeah.
But you also are tapped into really good stuff,
yes,
too.
Yes.
And it's like an amplification or intensification of what somebody who isn't on the path yet might,
that's,
experience.
Right.
Let's talk about a specific example. The one I love is St. Francis of Assisi, where the UFO experience becomes a forcing function to become a better person. But also that involves a lot of hardship for him. He starts out this sort of popular, you know, life of the party guy.
Yeah.
And then he has his UFO experience and, like, basically, like, dies from it. Oh, do you want to tell the full account?
Yeah. Okay. So what happens is that Francis is praying and something comes out of the sky, and the way that it's described is that there's a lot of, like, sparks, and it seems kind of spinning, and there's an eye, right, that comes down, and there's different versions of it too. So that's what people need to know, is that there's the artistic version of it and the dogmatic version of it. So the information I was able to get was that the angel was harsh with him. Okay. Now, I'm not quite sure what that means, but that's how it gets translated. So it deals harshly with him, and he receives burns, maybe. So this is then interpreted as being the stigmata, and it's interpreted as the angel, like Jesus talking to him, like, you know, how this messenger coming down and talking to him. Now, this isn't unlike things that you see today, like in contemporary, you know, UFO. That's the thing that I was trying to point out, was that this looks very similar to things that people talk about today.
Radiation damage and all the,
yeah,
stuff, Kit Green,
yeah,
and Gary,
like,
Nolan,
Gary Nolan's
about
work. I mean, yeah, that's when it really hit me, was I was actually at the New Mexico site, and we hadn't gone there yet. It was the night before, and we were all just hanging out, having a beer. And Gary decided he was going to share his research with us, and photos and everything, and it took like 2 hours to go through a lot of this stuff. And I was horrified at, you know, because he's doing And in fact, part of his motivation was to try to stop this from happening, right, to people.
Do you think that my mind went, for whatever reason, when you were talking about the story of St. Francis of Assisi to the Ark of the Covenant and the holiest of holies, and you have to be a certain level of purity to make contact, and if you don't, then somehow it does violence to you or something.
So do you, okay, so this question of your purity or else, okay. So in a lot of traditions that have these, you know, that discuss this contact with non-human intelligences, whether we interpret them as like deities or, you know, UFOs or whatnot, a lot of them do have this similar idea as in the Merkaba tradition, right?
Yeah.
You do have to be, and by the way, you also see this in the Socratic tradition, but strangely, it's with philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have to be a certain age and you have to have done so much math, mm-hmm. and purified yourself in order to understand philosophy, like truth and things like that. So you see this. So now I don't know if that's true or not, but
yeah.
this is the historical fact that people believe this and people have prepared themselves to do this. Now, listen. When people ask me, because a lot of people do, I have people say I go talk to a class or, you know, do some podcast, and I'll have somebody ask me, how can I make contact, right? And I don't recommend that at all.
Yeah, right. Right, especially not in some sort of recreational, you know, like it's fun or whatever, like good luck. You know?
Yeah, I don't recommend it.
No, it's dangerous, I think. If it happens, it'll happen when you least expect it. And you should just, reality is set up the way it is for a reason, I think.
Yeah.
And you can just move through your own life and contemplate virtue and get where you need to go through that. And then
mm-hmm.
I do think, yeah, it's like staring at the sun for too long when you study this stuff or whatever.
It's the heroic dose.
Yeah, totally.
Just don't do it.
Just don't do it. Or two steps forward, one step back, and don't always go looking for it. And
so,
do you think that the Last Supper was some sort of hermetic ritual? Was it like maybe a mystery ritual? Like there's another religious studies professor at Princeton, I believe, named Elaine Pagels.
I know her.
You know her?
She's great.
And she wrote Beyond Belief.
Yeah, she's great.
And she
yeah.
talks about mm-hmm. the Gospel of Thomas.
Yeah.
And how Jesus takes Thomas aside, whispers secret words to him. And maybe the whole thing, even if you read the Book of John, the whole thing, there's a reading of it where the whole thing feels a little more choreographed than you might expect.
Yeah.
And so do you think maybe the wine was like the kekion, you know, this Greek drink spiked with ergot that maybe allowed him to see beyond the veil, and then there's this other sort of, we're getting deep conspiracy territory, but I'm friends with Randall Carlson and, you know, Brian Marescu, and they suspect maybe Jesus never died, and Joseph of Arimathea actually just took Jesus in, who was lifeless when Pilate sort of poked him, but actually resuscitated him with herbs. This is probably all very heretical for your religious studies professor. So if you feel like you need to say this
heresies.
Is bullshit, please just let me know.
But Elaine Pagels also studies. Yeah. So she studies heretics. So,
Okay. Well, so is there any
We don't have any. We're not like practitioners, or if we are, we don't bring it into our work.
Certain Gnostic interpretations of the New Testament maintain the belief that Jesus actually never died, that the Last Supper was all more of a choreographed mystery ritual than meets the eye, where Jesus was sedated and then resuscitated. Take Luke 22:10. Jesus tells the disciples,
"Keep your eyes open as you enter the city. A man carrying a water jug will meet you. Follow him home. Then speak with the owner of the house. The teacher wants to know, where is the guest room where I can eat the Passover meal with my disciples?"
Already there are references to something going on behind the scenes. Who's the guy with the water jug? Then in the book of Matthew, Jesus says,
"Verily I say unto you, that one of you shall betray me."
So he knows he's about to be betrayed. And then he drinks hyssop, an herbal sedative. Maybe so the Romans think he's dead. In fact, the popular account has Jesus dying within 6 hours while on the cross, which doesn't really make biological sense. The apocryphal Gospel of Thomas goes even further. These are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke and which Judas Thomas wrote down.
And he said, "Whoever finds the interpretation of these sayings will not experience death."
So all of a sudden, the disciple supposedly betraying Jesus is maybe his closest confidant, recording the secret knowledge of immortality. Joseph of Arimathea, who is supposedly a disciple as well, indicating that there are more than 12 disciples, then comes to retrieve Jesus' body. Joseph embalms him with herbs, myrrh, and aloe, which you might do if you were trying to resuscitate someone. The text even reads that Pilate granted Joseph the corpse of Jesus, using the Greek term patoma, or a lifeless body. But when Joseph asks for the body of Jesus, he uses the word soma, meaning to save, heal, or make the body whole. Finally, when the disciples go to roll away the stone of the sepulcher, it had already been rolled away, maybe by a recently resuscitated Jesus.
Is there any chance, do you think, that the Last Supper was a mystery ritual?
Okay, or? So I have to talk as a not practitioner here.
Sure.
You know, and as a religious studies professor.
Yeah.
So listen, when I look at that ritual,
yeah,
you know, the Last Supper,
yeah,
which is, they're Jewish, so it's a Seder, right?
Yeah, exactly, Passover.
Yeah. Okay. But we have to wonder why it was uptaken then into the Roman Catholic Church, because right, it wasn't like the Agape feasts. They weren't really that. They weren't that ritual.
Right.
So then let's think about this. What distinguishes like certain types of institutions or societies from some sorts of institutions that are more like smaller institutions, like tribal villages or indigenous communities? They basically believe in the presence of, you know, spirituality in many, many things, like in forests, in rivers, you know, sky beings, in trees and things like that. So there's a sense of presence. Well, then, you know, what happens in the institution of Rome is there's this, like, there's no presence, right? And so you make this, what they're doing is they're recreating presence. I think so.
And what do you mean by presence exactly?
Well, okay, so if you're Catholic and you're Orthodox, you know this, that that ritual is supposed to be when the priest does the transubstantiation of, it's supposed to be the actual presence of Jesus. You hear the bell in the Mass, it goes ding, and then that's the presence, not just the, it's also the bread and the wine become the blood and the body. And that's not symbolic for Catholics or for Orthodox. It becomes symbolic for Protestants.
And so, oh, wow. So is Catholicism more sort of cannibalistic than we realize or something? Like,
well,
like you're eating? Yeah,
it is. Of course. I mean, yeah, there's like an altar.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to tell you this and you'd be shocked.
Yeah.
That this happens to my students.
Yeah.
When we talk about, you know, I say, okay, when you went, but a lot of them are Protestants, so they don't know that this is what Catholics and Orthodox Christians are doing when they're like doing this thing on the altar. And this brings me back to let's talk about René Girard.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because René Girard is like, this is exactly what he's talking about, because he talks a lot about structural violence, right? Structural violence. So he basically asks, why are we so mean to each other? Like, why do we always feel the need to kill one another?
Yeah.
Like, what is this? And so I think about my life, you know, as a young person, going through college, then going through graduate school, and all the books that I read, like some of them really stood out to me. And they were Plato's Republic, which asked, could there be a just society? And there were the Gospels of Jesus, right? Obviously, I became a religious studies professor. And there was René Girard's work. Really, each of these texts say that this is structural. You know, so when you think, like, you know, as a kid kind of growing up with parents who were liberal, you know, we got to save the world. Well, yeah, we do have to save the world. But the thing is that it's structural. The bad is structural.
Right.
You can't do enough.
Yes. And Girard is interesting because, yeah, he had sort of a bit of a cult following as a professor. And I think there's a Roberto Colasso quote there, foxes and their hedgehogs. You know, there's people that know a lot about a lot, and then there's somebody that knows one thing, and you can apply it. It's sort of a grand theory of everything.
Oh yeah, that's him. That's
That was Rene Girard, because he was sort of a hedgehog.
Yeah.
And in his case, I think he thought that the history of the world was the history of violence, and you had these sort of pagan scapegoating cycles. And there's something, the only thing that is, in some sense, he situates Christianity as a non-unique religion, because it's just another scapegoating story.
That's right.
But the way in which it is unique is that it sort of signals the end of history, because for the first time, the mythology and the story is taking the side of the scapegoat and not the mob, not the masses, which then you sort of unlock this idea that is both maybe saving of humanity, but also destroying of it. Like it sort of signals the end of the world or something. Because the scapegoating rituals are cathartic control processes to keep society moving forward, where you have sort of rivalrous interactions around kind of desires that everybody have that are emergent. And the scapegoat is then ritually sacrificed, and then society can, that pacifies society, and it can keep going. But it can't keep going if you know that you're doing a wrong thing in scapegoating this character. And so there's something about Christianity which is subversive and messes with this technology that keeps the world going in a way that sows the seeds of the apocalypse.
That's right. That's right. So the thing is that we, and by the way, A plus on that.
Thank you.
That was really amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. So the thing about it though is that, so the Christian recognition that we killed Jesus. Right?
Yes.
We are the ones.
Yes,
that,
the guilt.
Yeah.
The depravity.
Right.
Yes.
And so he rightly, remember we talked about a defense mechanism.
Mm.
Like a student asked me the other day, you know, what's hopeful, or is there something to hope for? And I said, yes, you know. But in part of the answer, we were talking about religion. Does religion offer hope? And in one sense, yes. But in another sense, it's a defense mechanism, right? And it defends us against. So, you know, religion springs up as a defense against our need to be this violent and to hurt each other like this and to kill the neighbor, you know, because we want what the neighbor has. And Christianity, the beauty that Girard interprets Christianity as being. Mm. And by the way, a lot of times I don't think Christianity lives up to Girard's idea.
Mm.
Because once we then perform this constantly, we become, like, you didn't even know that it was a sacrifice, this mass, you know? So the reality of it is that we're in the ritual and we kill, we kill this innocent victim. We're killing a perfect good person is what we're doing. And then eating them, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, but once we start to do this again and again and again, we just don't know what we're doing anymore. And then people act, we become programmatic.
Yes.
People don't have, so that's why I think something like a UFO then comes in to break that up and basically say, there's something here and it's actually not within your program.
Yes. And I think if you see the synchronicities, you sort of know you're on the right path. You know, you're in some like exciting whirlpool. When you see the signs.
Yeah. Okay. I learned a bit about this, actually.
Yeah.
Tyson Yunkaporta's book, Sand Talk, is really good, by the way.
Cool.
But he calls these synchronicities and these kinds of things that happen extracognitive events.
Yeah.
Okay. And he says that they're natural things. What they do is they, and I got this from studying creativity, is that they actually provide dopamine, right?
Wow.
Yeah. So when you're like doing something that's really creative and maybe even productive, like creating a technology or something, then you're going to really enjoy it. Like, you know, when people get into a creative space and they just go and they can't stop, that's what's happening with them.
Yeah. Wow. So it's like intermittent reinforcement where like you get a little dose of the dopamine or something.
That's right. That's right. I kind of think that synchronicities are more how it actually is. And that when we get out of our program, we actually go, whoa, okay, this is how it is. But then we just go back into our program because we're all trained. right, to on a program.
That brings you back to the Girard.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, the defense mechanism theory.
Yes.
That we have of life that we figured out.
What do you think is the relationship between time and UFOs? Is there some interesting relationship? Are they from the future? Are aliens and Close Encounters of the Third Kind just experiences with our future selves? Or yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Okay, so what's really interesting is that, okay, so after the, you know, around 2019 or so, I started to meet people who were people from technology communities, right? Yeah. Techies, basically.
Yeah.
And a lot of them really resonated with Tyler and recognized themselves. Mm. And a lot of them were creators of AI. Mm. And some of them did quantum computing and things like that. And so I started to engage with them because I was learning from them. And I was learning about this whole idea of, you know, what are these things, right? And so I thought that their ideas were very interesting because the normal idea is that they're extraterrestrial, which means that they're from another solar system or even our solar system, who knows, and they've somehow, you know, have some kind of craft that comes here.
Yeah.
This is supported by craft retrieval, you know, talk and stuff like that, and they come here. But that doesn't accord with what people see when they see them in the sky.
No.
You know, they kind of disappear and reappear, disappear, reappear.
Yes.
So this would suggest something entirely different, or that, you know, we just don't understand that technology that they have. So AI people being really smart and generally very self-confident believe that they could figure it out. So they've been talking about the temporal aspects of it, right? So they're, and by the way, this guy named, Stephen Dick, who is a NASA historian and has been for like 40 years. He's now retired, but he's on the research team for the Galileo project. I've corresponded with him for about a long time, since the beginning of my study, which is in 2012. He's been doing this for a long time. And more than 20 years ago, he suggested that these were AI, a form of AI, or that if we met them, they would be a form of AI. And so this accorded with what Jacques Vallée said, that they're technological, right?
Or it's like cellular automata, or these sort of control systems that it's like if you were trying to get, so this is like rats in a prime number maze. They don't understand the concept of prime numbers, right? So there's no way you can say turn right every single time you hit a prime number.
Right.
But with Pavlovian conditioning or intermittent reinforcement, you could get them to run a prime number maze. They don't know what they're doing.
No, they're just going on the impulse to get the treat or
but whatnot. They're implementing some grand plan or kind of grand plan in the process, a plan that you know.
Right, right.
And so maybe these are AI envoy von Neumann replicators or something that nip at the herd in ways that we don't know. It's like, why Betty and Barney Hill and why Antonio Villas-Boas? Like, why these specific people? But it might be moving us, swaying society in a specific teleology or something.
Well, yeah. So in conversations with some of these AI people, they were basically saying that now that we've, you know, we have that the discovery is true of superposition in this, you know, what it shows us is that there is this, you know, place beyond space-time and there's information there. And so this is information coming to us and it's intelligent and that it doesn't have the same, it doesn't have the same, or it's that the carrier is different, right? So it's not us.
Well, I don't want to forget this because we were talking about Tyler. You go to the Vatican Observatory with him.
Yes.
And he has a conversion experience.
Yes.
And so, okay, can we talk about that? Because that seems like this profound thing where he bursts into tears and he says, all I want to do, I don't care if I ever go back into the space program. All I want to do is help people.
Yeah, because he was really doing a lot of this. He wasn't really conscious about what he was doing. He was just doing it, right? This was his job. He was doing it since he was really young and he was really good at it. He knew what to do. He knew how to do it. Okay. So then when he met me, I told him what he was doing and that forced him to start to think about, wait, this has been happening.
Yeah.
And so when we went to the Vatican, this priest comes up to him and then they engage and then the priest somehow immediately decides that he's going to take on Tyler, like a mentor or something.
Yeah.
And he even blesses the project. Uh-huh. Yeah, so there's a picture of him blessing like the project, which hadn't even been named. Or it may have been named. I don't know. It was American Cosmic. He blessed it. He's just a really nice guy. I'm just going to call him Father K.
Cool.
Father K would take us to his chapel, which is outside the Vatican in Rome. And it was at a hospital. And he would take us on his round. So we would go to the hospital in the morning, do mass, and then go on his rounds. And he would take us to people who were ill, some of them terminally ill. And he would have us help him give, it's not last rites, but it's like, it's a rite of healing to very sick people. And he would do that. And some of the people made a huge impression on Tyler because there was a man who was fairly young and, you know, was there to, he was terminally ill. And I don't think that Tyler had ever been around somebody. He dedicated their lives basically to other people. I saw that he started to get internal and started to become like reflective about himself. And I could feel that this was happening, but I didn't know it was going to happen. I just could sense that something was happening like this. So then that's when we went to the observatory. And in the observatory, the observatory is the Catholic observatory. It's run by a Jesuit monk who's, you know, an astronomer.
MIT trained.
Yeah, yeah. He's like really, you know, he and Tyler could have some good conversations, right? So the people that are there and populate the observatory are the kind of people that would be like in the space program, but they're super religious. They're Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so I had this feeling that when Tyler met them, that it would be over for him, mm-hmm. that he would definitely know that there was, you know, there was something great and truthful and, you know, there was something like a God, right? Mm. Actually, strangely enough, the International Space Agency people were there, like 30 of them or so, and they were all really young. Yeah. It was like a whole thing for the International Space Agency, young astrophysicists and stuff. And they actually knew who Tyler was.
Wow.
Yeah. Because no one knows who he is here. He kind of got overcome with, like, I wouldn't say emotion, but maybe it was emotion. He got overcome with, like, the epic nature of what was happening and of what we were doing. And looking at, like, actual books that were written by Copernicus, like, first editions and stuff, you know? I mean, it was really amazing.
And Copernicus had he was, obviously came up with the theoretical model that the solar system revolves around the sun and that we live in a heliocentric universe. But he had a very interesting relationship with the sun. It was almost like a very spiritual endeavor.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Isaac Asimov actually has a great book called The Kingdom of the Sun, and it's about our relationship to the sun throughout history. And there's a whole section dedicated to Copernicus, who was a very mystical thinker when it came to the sun.
Fascinating. I did not know that.
Yeah, and I think of the sun, too, as like it's like a nuclear fusion. It is a nuclear fusion reactor.
Yeah.
And it sort of powers the earth. And Henri Bergson, which we just spoke about, is, you know, kind of French mystical, but also kind of science, maybe pseudoscientific thinker in the early 20th century, late 19th century, also thought that the sun specifically spurred on evolution. Like it was somehow essential to the evolution of mankind. And so maybe it's a combination of the electromagnetic field of the earth, the new sphere, Pierre Desjardins, and then also this sort of the sun as well. But
that's fascinating.
Anyway, back to, so Tyler is studying this stuff. And do you think in some ways for Tyler it was a convergence of Catholic faith, but also his life being dedicated to space?
Absolutely.
That was, it probably made him realize just how profoundly meaningful his past life had been.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's exactly what happened. Because I knew that he had a profoundly meaningful life, but because he was in this community of being secret, you know, the Fight Club community that I discussed, no one could ever know it. So then to have him recognized by international space scientists, you know, the European International Space Scientists, it was a beautiful thing, to tell you the truth. And then he decided to convert. And here I am doing this, you know, this study for years and years. And then this kind of happens. But also what happens is he changes his idea of what these things are that he's feeling, he's getting signals from. So he feels that they're more in line with what, because we were studying saints who had these experiences, and he was thinking that they're more in line with what they were, you know, experiencing too.
And he comes from a line of, you've talked about Tsiolkovsky, the father of Russian rocketry, or Jack Parsons, who had claimed to be kind of in contact with entities. You know, Wernher von Braun would say all sorts of trippy stuff. You know,
he's
the father of German rocketry, and then went on to run the NASA Saturn project, which took us to the moon. And so is there something about the history of the American, or just space programs in general, that is more consciousness-based than we somehow realize?
The Russian space program was inspired by early rocket scientists like Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who had basically constructed his own cosmic religion or worldview around space. This included a belief that humans would colonize the Milky Way, achieve immortality, regulate the forces of nature at will, and transition our biosphere into a new sphere, a mental network. He also believed humans would achieve time travel. His American counterpart, Jack Parsons, was equally unbounded by convention. He was part of the Pasadena cult OTO, along with Scientology creator L. Ron Hubbard. The two would perform sex magic rituals, and Parsons even received a past life regression in which he was Simon of Magus, a biblical character who used black magic to levitate. All of that is to say, maybe the true history of American and Russian space programs is stranger than meets the eye.
Yes, they were doing some extraordinary types of rituals, and they definitely believed that they were in touch with these beings. They presented them differently. So the Parsons crew, they were way out there. And they were doing this in the LA desert, right? And stuff, and they were doing ritual magic, and they believed that they were in contact with, you know, extraterrestrials and things like that. All right. On the Russian side, though, they were doing the same thing, but it was under a Christian veneer. So Tsiolkovsky believed that he was actually in touch with angelic beings, and he talks about it and writes about it, and that these beings are in constant contact with us if we're able to receive their knowledge.
So do you have a sense of the relationship between the secret space programs and religion in its totality? Do you think that these things are two sides of a pyramid that sort of converge at some omega point or something?
Are you asking about the religiosity of the space program? Because there seems to be one.
I am asking that.
Yeah, okay.
Is it sort of a Gnostic religious initiation process or what?
I'm still trying to figure it out, but I do have some data on it.
Yeah.
So it looks to be, and actually, strangely enough, at the end of one of Tom DeLonge's book, actually, he makes a reference to the gods are still with us. The Greek gods are still with us, which I didn't know about, actually, until about 2 weeks ago. And it was really interesting to hear, because I had just given a talk that I didn't want recorded. I went to New York City and I was giving a talk, and the name of the talk was "The Muse is Real." Okay. I went from the very first idea of muses, you know, thousands of years ago for the Greeks, and then how they kind of, they never really go away. So even the founding fathers, quote unquote, of our country, like Benjamin Franklin, did you know that they were actually part of a Mason lodge that was a muse lodge? It was dedicated.
Yes. I knew he was a Freemason. Yeah. I don't know. He's part of a muse lodge.
It was like the Seven Sisters.
Wow.
It was a French muse lodge.
Talk about a guy with a million ideas. He invented the bifocals, a certain type of harpsichord, you know, famously was involved in electricity experiment. Like, he was a complete polymath, and so it was probably tapped into all sorts of ideas.
Isn't that interesting? Well, they knew it to be real. That's what I was saying in my talk, was that it wasn't just something that we think of them today, the muses, and we often think of them as just like motifs or allegories or, you know, but we never actually think of them as something that could be real.
Yeah. Well, the etymology of the word genius is attendant spirit, and it's kind of
That's right.
Okay.
A lot of our words come from muse, by the way. Like museums is about the muse. In fact, museums were supposed to contain the spirit of the muses. Did you know that?
I don't know.
Isn't it interesting that we have a lot of museums in DC and a lot of architecture about the muses. What? It's everywhere. Oh. Well, it's also in the space program. So what I found was that when Tyler would do these launches, there would be a lot of iconography that he didn't actually understand when I met him. Mm-hmm. I would ask him, I say, why are they using this Greek goddess, you know? And he's like, is that a Greek goddess? Mm-hmm. It is indeed. And they would use Latin and they would send it up into space.
Really?
Yeah. And so he said that, and by the way, it wasn't medieval Latin, which is a Catholic form of Latin, uh-huh. a Roman Catholic form. It was like first, second century type of Latin, wow. which is Roman Empire Latin. You know, what does this mean? I don't know. Other than that, I think that there's almost like a parallel type of religion that's happening.
Well, we have a mutual friend, Dr. Ea Whiteley. You introduced me to her.
She's
a new friend for me. She's written about in your next book, Encounters,
yes,
which is an incredible book.
That's right.
And I think what she talks about and writes about and deals with in her professional life is when you talk about space technology, whether it's rocketry or anything else, it's so complicated and it's so hard to get right. Even SpaceX succeeded on its fourth attempt when it was on the verge of failure and bankruptcy. And it was almost like a spiritual reckoning that Elon had to go through where he put half his money in and almost failed and then it finally worked. And that almost feels like the story again and again. Jack Parsons famously said after he read The Golden Bough by J.G. Fraser, he said, I read that book and I realized science is a form of magic and not vice versa, which no other scientist or engineer would ever say, but it humbled him so much, making rocketry. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what somebody like Ea Whiteley deals with is once you've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's, the tech is so complex that if there's any sort of mind-matter interaction, you have to get that right too. Mm-hmm. In the case of space.
That's right.
And so she deals with like the mentality of a fighter pilot. And McDonnell Douglas, which is an aerospace corporation, at Wash U in St. Louis had a parapsychology program. Aerospace was definitely interested in parapsychology at some point.
Yep.
And the dirty little secret about parapsychology is your internal state really dictates how good you are at the thing. It's almost like the Book of Acts with Jesus, where you have to reach a certain level spiritually to do well with it.
Yeah, so like your body's an instrument.
Yeah, and it begs this question, because 2017 and on is when the UFO thing really started to become more popular and kind of in the zeitgeist since Leslie Kane wrote her article about, you know, ATIP and the fact that we even had a UFO
yes.
program.
Yeah.
But that was the same year that, due to a lawsuit, the Stargate stuff, you know, the psychic spy program was actually sort of wrested from the government and made public. And so there's a part of me that thinks that maybe there's more of an emphasis on nuts and bolts. And actually the more interesting stuff is sort of parapsychological and involves mind over matter and consciousness. But what do you think?
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. So the thing is that, you know, here you have in 2013, you know, I began my study in 2012, do the normal academic search for the space program information, immediately see how much is classified and that I can't do that. And then think, okay, I can do field research, right? And I can learn from people, which is, you know, your next best bet, right? And not that I'm trying to uncover anything, to tell you the truth, because I don't actually care to tell you. I mean, honestly, I didn't go in with any kind of an agenda.
Yeah.
I just went in because I was curious and I saw that my former research basically, you know, my former research was basically on aerial phenomena and Catholic history, but interpreted as angels and souls from purgatory.
Yeah.
You know, so I've been doing the research. It was post 20th century. And so then I recognized that it was still happening and I thought, very interesting. And so that's what got me interested in doing that. But I think this whole focus, I don't want to be conspiratorial, but yeah, this whole focus on nuts and bolts takes us away from what I found really to be the case.
And it sounds like they were interested in your work on St. Joseph the Divine, who could levitate, and
very much so.
Other kind of historical figures in Catholic history that could literally levitate. I remember one time I was talking with Hal Puthoff, and he said to me, I was like going really deep on science and like, you know, vector and scalar potentials that the, you know, kind of quantum field breaks down into and how that could, you know, be the mechanism through which telepathy occurs or, you know, whatever. And I remember he cuts me off and he goes, or it could be a medieval secret society that knows how to levitate, and they put these metal capsules around them. And I was like, what? Like, that was the weirdest thing he had ever said. And I just remember that forever. Like, it was as if maybe the levitation history that you know is somehow tied in with, the UFO story. And maybe we go down these really deep rabbit holes of science and, you know, how to reconcile UFOs with, you know, we talk about Alcubierre, you know, warp drives and whatever. And maybe it's just sort of the human body is somehow way more integral to this.
It seems like it's not just the human body in and of itself. It's like groups of people too, because I noticed that there was a lot of, so I have, because, you know, I've been a scholar of Catholic history, and I'm in conversation with Hal actually about these very things, about levitation in the past and levitation here and now, and looking at the data, right?
Yeah.
And so what's interesting, and I have looked at so much data, I mean, I have the Joseph of Cupertino records, right?
Yeah.
And been reading them, and they're pretty intense. And it's really difficult to read through the whole thing without coming away saying, heck yeah, that guy levitated, right?
Joseph of Cupertino was a 17th century Franciscan friar that would experience ecstatic visions as a child. And many people witnessed him levitating while participating in Mass. He was deemed holy by many of these witnesses, which the church thought was subversive. Eventually, they imprisoned him in a small cell, forbidding him to join any public gatherings in the community. He had his own strict protocols of asceticism, only eating solid food twice a week and adding bitter powders to all his meals.
And so when I started to look back at some of the research data that I had from my Catholic history stuff, I started to notice the people who were the people who were said to have levitated or who received these miraculous interventions and things. They seemed to either be doing protocols, or they were children, or they were somehow childlike or had a childlike goodness about them. And so I don't know, I haven't concluded anything about this. This is just very initial data collection.
Marty, do you have anything?
Let me see my notes. Just something like in the book while I was listening that you keep coming back to is the idea that you can't take the context outside of the experience of the experiencer. And in a culture and in a moment of time where we're so obsessed on, you know, a hyper indexing of data and collecting more and doing more, it was a fresh perspective to really get to fully consider someone's full story and the circumstances that they come with for why they might have had that experience. So that was more of a statement, not a question. Where am I going?
But it actually helps me, because I was going to bring that up.
Okay, amazing. Mm.
So when we look at the history of UAPs here in the States, right? Okay, we've got actually three traditions, research traditions. We have the invisible tradition, represented, I would say, by people like Alan Hynek. Okay, so they're in the intelligence community, and there are things going on, and there's research going on, but it's not public at all. It's not transparent, for probably good reasons. And then what happens is that you get people like who do it as their hobby. So you get ufology, and it's public facing, and it's public scholarship about UFOs. And then from there, you get academic scholarship. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you have, again, you have people like John Mack. John Mack comes along. He's a Harvard University psychiatrist, and he's actually in conversation with Bud Hopkins. Mm-hmm. He's looking at experiencers. And then what we have is we have a fourth tradition, all right? And that fourth tradition has just arisen in the last less than 10 years, okay? And I use myself as an example of it, because you have somebody who stumbles upon something that I'd never thought to study, but recognizes that I've been studying something similar to it, if not it, my entire life, and meets this person named Tyler, who's part of the first tradition, right? The secret tradition. And what happens is a collaboration, and then a transparency that we've never seen before. And so what do we call this fourth tradition? Okay. What do we call this fourth tradition? All right. So what I've tried to do is I tried to say, what kind of tradition would this be? And I thought, you know, the strange thing about it, let me actually talk about the context of it, the research context. We never talk about that. What's the research context? Well, you and I just talked about Jack Parsons and Tchaikovsky in Russia. So we actually talked about the context of them creating something entirely novel that actually does something operational and gets us off of Earth, right? And so I decided to look at my context, the research context between somebody in religious studies and somebody in the Space Force, boom, collaborating almost accidentally. It's emergent.
Yes.
It's an emergent thing. So what comes out of it is completely what people use the term emergence for. Hmm. You know, something bigger than its parts. Because we're just these kind of parts that come together, right? And all of a sudden we work together and something comes out of it.
Well, that I think brings us to a question, which is like, are we on the verge of an epistemological paradigm shift? Because I think about the Invisible College, which was J. Allen Hynek's group with Jacques Vallée, which is a tongue-in-cheek reference to Robert Boyle's Invisible College, which was kind of at the start of the Enlightenment. Sort of study science, which at the time was considered heretical and outside of the confines of
dangerous.
The church. It was dangerous. And I think about how the Enlightenment started, and there's a good book by Francis Yates about sort of the Rosicrucian roots of the Enlightenment, and the Invisible College is sort of a Rosicrucian
term. Oh, it totally is.
Term.
Yeah, yeah.
And the goal of Rosicrucianism was sort of to marry the science and the spirit. A lot of the early Enlightenment proponents were also alchemists. And it feels like we are now living in a time where science is, you have kind of Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, like very shrill kind of defenders of the materialist paradigm. And then you have kind of dogmatic religious fundamentalists, and they have bifurcated or cleaved since the Enlightenment. And now emergently they're coming together. Like the fact that a religious studies professor is collaborating with a secret space program person who's a mission controller who's worked on all these missions since the Challenger in the 80s is wild.
Yeah.
And so where are we headed?
Well, that's the thing. So I was trying to quantify it today, you know, so to kind of say, well, what can I leave people with? And I thought, that's probably not the best thing to do because I'm just a part.
The idea of disclosure, as it's currently happening, being a very colonial concept, because it assumes that it's like this newfound, like we're discovering this for the first time. I think when we are trying, when we try to reduce things so much to like the observables that we can write in these specific formats, and we think that the human account of a story is the weakest. I mean, Johnny Harris is really like, the weakest scientific measurement is when you actually rely on the human story. And I'm like, but what else do we have?
That's all you have.
So that part was fat. I had never heard that perspective, and it clicked. It clicked so well.
I know. So that's part of also the reason that I wrote it, was that disclosure can only happen because the U.S. government has the information, right?
Exactly.
And it's like, really? And that, but you talk to other countries and you talk to people in
Native American tribes.
Yeah, exactly. Aboriginal Australians, indigenous Australian tribes. And they even have these, you know, different initiation ceremonies for it. Just like you and I talked about the Merkaba tradition, you know. And so, so I just wanted to put a light on that, just to kind of, I don't think I could ever balance out that discourse that's happening now, but I wanted to put it out there.
There is some hubris in saying we are now going through disclosure or whatever. Yeah. And it is what frustrates me about the sometimes the super anti-UFO people, and often the anti-UFO people like were super pro-UFO, like it's two sides of the same coin. And it's like, you're relying too much on the intel community. Like, because sometimes people will come after me because I interview people in that world or whatever. And I'm like, they could flip tomorrow and it wouldn't change my belief in this stuff, because I know there's so much outside of what they're talking about. And maybe there are ways in which the government is spinning things, but like, I don't care. There's so much open source knowledge. You're over relying on the government in studying this. And I think Encounters is a really great kind of comprehensive overview of how you can study this outside of official channels. Do you ever get skeptical when you hear, like when the biologics thing messes with me, and it messes, you know, it's sometimes it's, I do think this is, it's the interesting thing about the UFO phenomena is that it is the intersection between something that's a little parapsychological and consciousness based, but it's also sort of objective and real. And that's really interesting and cool. But when I hear people say, you know, there are these many races, and it's like grays and tall whites and reptilians or something. I don't know. There's a part of me that believes it. I'm like, okay, maybe. But then there's another part of me that just feels like I have like an allergic reaction to it. I'm like, this isn't like even my, I have a very open, I'm very high on the openness scale. And I'm like, I don't know. Do you have any beliefs about that? Or?
Well, I mean, I'm used to hearing stuff like this because I study religion.
Yeah.
So in religions, you have those things too. Like you have non-human intelligences of all sorts that are identified, like, you know, the medieval angelologies, right? Mm. Of, you know, so if, of the Catholic Church, you know, they describe the different angels and what they do and, you know, things like that. So to me, it's like this taxonomy of entities, right? That people are now doing with DMT.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting to me. You know, maybe there are these things in these other dimensions that are like if two people sit down and they're taking, you know, DMT or they're doing and they have the same experience, but they don't talk to each other. Like what's going on?
This is like Andrew Gallimore in the Imperial College and stuff. They're sort of mapping the spirit world.
Yeah.
And then
it's really interesting. I mean, it's interesting as long as you don't become literally a believer.
Well, do you think any of these things are walking among us?
I know who it is that doesn't belong among us.
Oh, gosh.
Like when you read like Penetration by Ingo Swann or something, and he's like, you know, he's this famous remote viewer who's like involved in the beginning of the Stargate program.
Yes.
But then you read, you're halfway into the book, and he's like, and then I'm at the supermarket, and I see one, and you're like, what? Like,
and she's beautiful.
And she's beautiful.
Ravishing.
And she's ravishing.
So these things you see in religious traditions, too.
Yeah.
And you also see them in, somebody just emailed me and told me about traditions like that in Haiti. Mm. You know, and that, you know, he came to the United States, and he couldn't believe that we didn't have any belief in this at all. Mm. When he would see things like that when he was there, okay? And, okay, so what do I think about that? There are things we don't quite understand about, well, there's so many things we don't understand.
Yeah.
I mean, what am I going to say? Yeah. It's like, there's these kinds of questions I don't think I could say publicly.
Well, I tend to think human biology is fairly, what always interests me is the variance of humans. Like I meet certain people and I'm like, you are on some other thing. And then I tend to think in a lot of these cases, I'm like, but you bleed real blood. You're just like the Shylock line. You know, you bleed normal blood and you go to the bathroom and your body functions in a biologically human way, but you are sort of very tapped into something else.
Okay. So there's a couple stuff. This is my non-public research.
Yeah.
So I can't actually talk about it, but I can answer your question if you want.
Okay.
All right. So when I've done some research with people who talk about either mediumship or even possession. And what you find is that the boy who was at the basis, his story was used for The Exorcist, the first Exorcist movie, who then turned out to be like an aerospace engineer. I guess, did you hear about that? That boy?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he grew up to be like an aerospace engineer.
Whoa.
Yeah. And worked for NASA, I think.
Crazy.
Okay. So listen, though, is that while... After, you know, because it took a while for him to get depossessed, apparently. Mm. Okay, so this is the story. But afterwards, he went to the bathroom a lot. He urinated like tons and tons and tons and tons. So much that people were like, how are you even, it's not even possible. Okay, well, you also see this with other kinds of like mediumship and things like that. Oh. So something is happening physiologically to them. And I don't know what it is, but it has to do with water.
It's so
and hydration.
Hydration.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the memory of water stuff out of Japan?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
So it's like maybe water holds more semantic content than we realize or something.
Yeah.
But I had an experience at Skinwalker Ranch. I smelled sulfur there.
Yes.
And that's
right. It's common there.
It's common. It's a sign of like the devil.
It is. Yes.
And I proceeded to have the worst month of my life. And then at the end of the month, I felt like I was saved by God. Like God swooped in and saved me. And I prayed the whole month. It was horrible, like every day, like some gnarly, weird.
Wow.
It was like in a dark energy vortex. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's on camera, there's a video of me just candidly being like, I smelled something weird. And it smells like sulfur.
It smelled like the sulfur or whatever.
Oh, really?
You know what
fireworks is, right?
No.
So this is a hydrogen sulfate gas monitor?
Yeah.
And because, you know, like in mines and things like that gas, people smell the sulfur smell beforehand.
Yeah.
So I wear this so that if someone says that they smell something like that, we know the whether it's really gas or if it's something happening up here, because people that have had instances.
Is anything coming up?
No.
Okay.
No. So,
just like, what is that? Are we swimming in a soup of this stuff? Like, it's kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that's the sobering moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
The sobering moment is to recognize that it's a real kind of phenomenon.
Is that why it's being hidden from us? Like, sometimes I think Carl Sagan, who grew up writing about UFOs in his diary and would debate with his mentor all the time about them, and then somehow flipped into being super anti-UFO. You know, him writing The Demon Haunted World.
Yes.
I think of that as somewhat of a double entendre. And like, maybe it's like the world is haunted by demons, literally.
Yeah.
And then it's like the Screwtape Letters. You have to be like very hypervigilant about following the godly path, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And like fending them off. Because you have like Wormwood and Screwtape and you know, a bunch of bad entities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we can safely say that evil is real.
Evil
right?
is very real.
Because look, we have human trafficking and things like that. These are evil. But we're talking about like supernatural evil.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the human trafficking is human evil,
yes.
right? But we're talking about something called supernatural evil. So it's another category of evil that we're talking about. And I think when you get into the UFO scenario, you know, when you start to go into the communities and you're, you know, a little bit self-aware, you know, it does that thing that you explained earlier, you know, it's like a forcing function.
Yes.
And it causes you to see the reality of things that we weren't taught to believe in because we live in a fairly secular society. Even if we're religious, we're still secular, right?
So it's like the re-enchantment of the world.
It really is.
Are we on the verge of a paradigm shift, a re-enchantment of the world, a breakdown of the cold scientific paradigm that's run its course? Science has become the pervasive mythology of our time. It has a founding myth, the Big Bang, a miraculous event for which we don't really have too many plausible causal explanations. A teleology of primitive to progress evolution which makes us feel safe, and rituals that involve lab coats, beakers, and microscopes to gain deeper access to the secrets of the universe. In other words, it has all of the elements of a religion. Yes. Scientific breakthroughs require domain expertise, hard work, time, and diligence. But then there's a final step that no one can dissect involving spontaneous revelation. Whether that's Einstein constructing the photoelectric effect while bored at his Swiss patent desk, Wolfgang Pauli dreaming up the architecture of the hydrogen atom, Heisenberg at Helgoland, or Dirac staring at the fire in Cambridge. This last revelational step of science is inexplicable and irreducible, and it seems a lot like what we used to call divine inspiration. So what drives these epistemological shifts that seem to occur for mankind throughout history? Well, in her latest book called Encounters, Diana writes that she refrained from teaching her students one thing about Plato's cave allegory, the existence of the puppet masters. Who's controlling the shadows on the cave wall we see? Who's dropping the monolith and manipulating our reality?
Let's talk about Simone.
Yes.
Okay, so Simone's in the book. I have a chapter devoted to her. She does believe that we're living in a time of a revelation, literally, though. And what is being revealed is that is AI. And AI, she thinks, is hopeful because it will take the power out of a group that has had it for a very long time and distribute it. It's kind of like another French Revolution, but a definitive one.
But depending on how it goes, it could be like the Gutenberg press, or in a subversive, or it could be, you know, Biden just came out with regulations around it. And there are a few companies that feel like they're really on the frontier of, I think AGI is overhyped and BS, but like, you know, the harder core research. And then you have the CCP using AI for draconian 1984-like purposes. And so I do think it could go either way. It's like up to us. Like, history is being written.
Well,
all the UFOs are similar.
Yeah.
They're these sort of like generic templates, like AI, UFOs.
Right.
And it's almost like this golem-like thing that we're actively creating, and they can be evil or they can and totalitarian, or they can be good and personally
empowering.
Well, you
see, this is where I kind of differ.
Okay.
Jesse.
Well, let's get into it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So how I differ is I don't think it's up to us.
Mm.
The only thing that's up to us is our personal salvation.
Ah, I love that.
Yeah.
Totally.
And when I say personal salvation, I'm not talking about that in a strictly Christian way.
Mm.
I'm talking like about that in a human way. every one of us has, you know what that means, right? When I say that, we're all implicated. Every one of us. And that's necessary now.
Yeah.
Totally necessary. Like you said, that's why I like your idea of the forcing function
yeah.
of the UFO yeah. and AI.
Yes.
And so.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, worshiping them is bad. Both.
Oh, of course.
Like I interviewed the Google engineer that left because he thought that Lambda was sentient
right.
or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I came away thinking, cause I actually worked in AI at Google before getting my job.
I didn't know that.
Peter. Yeah. Yeah. And I came away, and I always was cynical about the AGI narrative, the idea that we'll have some hard takeoff and artificial general intelligence will realize that human meat space is being used efficiently kill us all or whatever. I just always was kind of cynical about that. And I think it's mostly statistics on steroids and not sentient, not actually conscious. But I came away from that interview being shocked at his belief. And I couldn't argue with his belief.
No,
and some
can't.
People might think about my own belief in UFOs is similar or something. And so I was like, whether or not the AI is conscious or not, the sociological repercussions of people impugning consciousness on the AI, that is going to be drastic and massive.
Yes,
and
totally.
It's the same with the UFOs.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I totally. You sound like a religious studies scholar. You know, you're doing the meta look at it instead of just taking it at face value.
Well,
belief in it is the issue. It doesn't matter whether it's real or not.
Right. Well, and then if you have a parapsychological worldview where belief is fundamental, then all of a sudden, that's a false dichotomy. And
that's right.
That's the most powerful thing.
Yeah.
What humans believe, or if you're a follower of Plato, belief is somehow just central to where society goes and what happens.
But the thing that we're asking now is, at this time in human history, I think that we need to see ourselves.
How the Greek would be like noesis, knowledge of your primordial soul. How do you, there's clearly no, formula.
Yeah. Well, there kind of is. And what is it?
Okay.
It's like self-examination.
Yes.
It's like, how do you feel now? Why do you feel that way?
Yeah.
Somebody comes into your space. Are they in need? What are you going to do about it? Kind of thing like that.
Yes.
These are the kinds of things that, that we just need to pay attention to us. And like I said, the UFO is probably out there to get us out of our program so we can actually do some self-examination.
How do you feel now?
Pretty awesome.
Me too. Yeah.
In Encounters, Diana also interviews a friend whose father was allegedly part of one of the secret American space programs, something like the one Tyler from American Cosmic was in. One thing her friend told Diana about her father gave me goosebumps and will probably stay with me forever. She says, a joke my father and his friends often exchanged consisted of one word, simulacrum.
Can I make one more point with you?
Make it, dude.
Okay. If you want to shatter the Western mental structures, the Western mind, so to speak, which is now permeating the whole earth in its materialist, dualistic philosophy, the way you do it is you take something that's supposed to be in the spirit world, because even in the West we can make allowance for the spirit world, and we can study it through mythology, through religion, through imagination, through poetry. But the one unforgivable sin to the Western mind is when something that should be in the spirit world transgresses and shows up in the physical world. That traffic is the cardinal sin for the Western mind. So it has great power to shatter the belief structure of the Western mind when that occurs. And that's precisely what's occurring in this subduction phenomenon.
Very good point. Thanks very much for talking with me. Good, good, good.